We don't think of ourselves as a corrupt country. You know, we think of ourselves as, you know, hey, it's nice and spiffy and clean. And, you know, if you encounter a police officer here in Washington, D.C., and you offer them a bribe, they will arrest you. I remember in the early 80s, I was down in Mexico. We were, I think it was Cancun or Acapulco, I forget which. But Louise and I owned a travel agency at that time. And I had with me one of the vice presidents of one of the larger technology companies that was based in Atlanta. I don't want to name the company. And we were going to look at a hotel. We, you know, as a travel agency, we were going to book a conference for this company. And they were going to have a conference in Acapulco, I'm pretty sure it was. So we got to the airport, we rented a car, and we're driving into town, and there's this long stretch of freeway that's like in the middle of nowhere, and I'm going the exact same speed as everybody else. But I'm the only guy who's driving what is obviously a rental car, and I don't look Mexican. And neither did the executive from this company who was with me. And a police officer on a motorcycle pulls us over. He comes over to the side window. He says, you know, you were going 50. And I said, I didn't see any speed limit signs. And I was just going the same speed as everybody else. He says, well, the speed limit here is only 25. I said, well, why was everybody else going 50? And he said, I don't know. I'm not worried about everybody else. You're the one I caught. And so he's writing a ticket while we're talking. And he says, it's there's going to be a fine associated with this. And you have to show up 7 days from today in court. And if you don't, an international arrest warrant will be issued for you. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to be here in 7 days. We're here for 2 days to look at a hotel. And he said, well, then you're going to have a real problem. I mean, you know, you're going to have to stay here. And I said, well, is it possible for me to pay the fine right now? Now, I know, you know, in some states, you can actually, in the United States, you can actually pay the parking or the speeding fine right there, you know, with the police officer. I did not, in my mind, have a bribe, right? I mean, it was literally just an honest question. Can I pay this fine right now? And he said, oh, yes, you can. He said $50 would do it. And so I got out $50 and I handed it to him. And he said, thank you very much. He put it in his pocket and very conspicuously tore the ticket in half right in front of me. And he said, well, that takes care of that. And thank you very much. Reached in and shook my hand and walked back to his motorcycle and drove off. And I'm like, I just paid a bribe. I didn't even intend to pay a bribe. That's how we think of corruption. But the fact of the matter is that the corruption that is happening in the United States is on such a far grander scale. You know, there are some 30,000 lobbyists here in Washington, D.C. since the Buckley decision. I mean, before Reagan, there was like 800 or 1,000 registered lobbyists in this town. Now it's like 30,000. It's mind-boggling. Before Reagan, only 5% of retiring members of Congress went on to become lobbyists. Now it's over half because it pays really well. Before the adoption of neoliberal policies, you know, a.k.a. Reaganism, and the maintenance of those policies through the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, and the Obama administration, the maintenance of those policies, to that time, we have corruptly... I mean, okay, so I gave $20 or $50 to a guy in Uganda, and here I am confessing to crimes on the air. I don't know what the statute of limitations is, but anyhow, and $50, as I recall, to a cop in Mexico. That's nothing. I mean, four blocks from where I am. Well, one block from where I am. Yeah, we're right around the corner from K Street, right here. There are companies who are handing hundreds of thousands. Millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases, to politicians or vice versa. There are politicians who are giving companies, in the form of legislation that they pass, who are giving companies profits in the billions in exchange for campaign contributions in the hundreds of thousands. The best investment you can make in the United States right now is to buy a member of Congress. You get the best return on it. It can be as high as 10,000 to one. So, you know, we don't think of ourselves as corrupt, but, you know, our country has become corrupted. It's become corrupted by this bizarre idea promulgated by the Supreme Court that money is speech. In Holland right now, in the Netherlands in 2013, just in that year alone, 3 years ago, they closed 19 prisons. They're going to close 5 more by the end of this summer. They had to import 240 prisoners from Norway just to keep one of their prisons full. Why are they closing their prisons? Well, because they can't. Number one, they relax their drug laws. Number two, they focus on rehabilitation. And number three, instead of putting people in jail, they put ankle monitors on them unless they're violent. So it's very few people in jail.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
To the point where it's a minor industry in Holland. Now, how does that relate to corruption? Well, our prisons are growing. Why? Because we've got a private prison industry lobbying Congress.
From studios underwritten in part by Sputnik Radio, this is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's Tom Hartman here with you the day after the 4th of July. We watched the fireworks last night, at least what we could see of them. I don't know if you watched them on C-SPAN. You saw a beautiful clear sky and crisp fireworks, and, you know, boy, did that look nice. And it turns out it wasn't last night's fireworks. And so Jessica Goldstein over on Think Progress, she says, okay, if we faked the fireworks, did we fake the moon landing? Wake up, sheeple. So one thing we didn't fake was James Comey coming out this morning and saying that, Hillary Clinton and her staff were, his phrase, extremely careless in handling their emails, but that no reasonable prosecutor would recommend charges, and no charges are appropriate, in his opinion. So I can tell you right now, over on the Rush Limbaugh show and all the right wing shows, people heads are exploding. You know, oh my God, the Clintons, oh, dude. You know, Republicans can't deal with this stuff well. So that's going to be interesting. We'll see where this. Well, actually, we're not going to see where this goes. This just ended. That's it. You know, the Bill meets with Loretta Lynch and all the hysteria and all the concern and for the small fraction of Bernie supporters who have been, you know, holding out hope that this would be the thing. It's gone. And it's gone. Oh, my. I hold out hope that Bernie, not just hope, actually, a very real sense that, you know, Bernie's going to continue to change America. Bernie is going to continue to lead his political revolution, that the country is going to continue to move forward. It's just, you know, he's not going to be president, he's not going to be running for president. But that doesn't mean that there's not a million things that he and you and I and everybody who supports him can't do at the same time that we're trying to make sure that no Republican gets in the White House, especially Donald Trump. But, you know, the Republicans might come to their senses in 2 weeks and kick him off the ticket. We'll see. So, you know, the whole Republican thing needs to be dealt with. Ashfi Molavi wrote a piece in Bloomberg News titled "The 4th of July Brought to You by Belgium, Brazil, and China." Robert Reich paraphrased it and posted his paraphrase along with a link to the original article over on his Facebook page about 6 hours ago. Or yesterday, actually, it must have been the 4th of July. And I just want to share with you what Reich said, because this is one of the issues that Bernie brought to the forefront. This is the issue that Donald Trump is out there pounding on. And in my opinion, he's lying about in terms of his own position and where he would go. And certainly he's out of step with the Republican Party on this. But it has to do with trade. So Robert Reich writes, today as you, this is the 4th of July, yesterday. Today as you imbibe a cold Budweiser owned by a Brazilian-Belgian conglomerate, smother your hot dog from Chinese-owned Smithfield Foods with Heinz ketchup owned by a Brazilian private equity group, finish up with cake from Sara Lee owned by Grupo Bimbo of Mexico, and ice cream from Good Humor, part of the British-Dutch conglomerate, check for movies on your ThinkPad laptop owned by China's Lenovo, and then head to a movie house owned by Dalian Wanda, the Chinese real estate agent or giant that controls more U.S. cinema screens than any other American company. In your Chrysler, owned by Italian automaker Fiat, and at the end of the day, take an Alka-Seltzer, also foreign-owned, you might be wondering what kind of interest they were celebrating. And he talks about how the U.S. has attracted nearly $3 trillion in what's called foreign direct investment, which is where foreigners come in here with dollars and they buy our companies, they buy our land, they buy our houses. They are the foreign purchase of American real estate right now is fueling a real estate bubble of rather epic proportions, particularly on the West Coast, mostly Chinese money. He says last year was a record for foreign investment, bringing in $348 billion. Foreign buyers also purchased $87 billion in U.S. real estate. And he's, and then, you know, and the article that he's quoting from Bloomberg cites this as just a wonderful thing. You know, isn't this, is, I mean, they don't have a whole lot of adjectives in here, but they point out that, you know, when you work for a foreign company in the United States, you're more likely to get better pay than when you're working for an American-owned company like, you know, McDonald's or Walmart. I mean, they don't name the companies, but and that these are jobs that they're creating, right? So they say, go ahead, crack that bud, and rest assured that even if companies in Belgium, Brazil, and China ultimately own some of what you eat, buy, and watch this weekend, you'll still be doing right by America. That's Bloomberg. Now, here's Robert Reich. He says, I don't see this as a problem except when it comes to our democracy, because all these foreign-owned firms are now playing a larger political role in Washington and state capitals than ever before. And their primary concern when they influence our politics isn't the well-being of Americans. It's their global profits, and there's a big difference. I would add to that, you know, when you're buying what you think are American products that are owned by foreign companies, some of them are even made in the United States. You know, your hot dogs or your ketchup, your Heinz ketchup, even though it's owned by a Brazilian company, you say, well, you know, it's made in American tomatoes, American ketchup. What's wrong with that? Well, here's what's wrong with that. All the profit goes to Brazil. When you buy your Fiat, all the profit goes to wherever it goes. Where's Fiat based out of? Italy. When you buy your Sara Lee Foods, the profit goes to Mexico. When you buy your ThinkPad, the profit goes to China. When you rent in the Chrysler building, your profit goes to Abu Dhabi. When you drink Budweiser, your profit goes to Brazil and Belgium. So it's the slow bleeding of America. It's like somebody has slit our wrist, but not like deep into the artery, just, you know, one of the little veins there on the outside. So we're walking around going drip, 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 drip. And you ask yourself, you know, okay, where did these guys get all these dollars to buy America, to buy $3 trillion worth of this country? Where'd the money come from? Well, the money came from our trade deficit. It came from us sending them dollars for their cheap junk because we no longer have tariffs and we don't use VAT taxes like all the other countries do to protect our domestic manufacturers from low-cost imports and to subsidize exports. We don't do that. Everybody else does that. We don't do that. Because we've got stupid trade, and it's not really stupid. It's very intentional. We have trade that benefits transnational corporations and foreign countries and not the United States and not our workers. Now, why would we do that? Because as Robert Reich points out, these foreign companies who are buying up America are able to make it all happen and keep these trade deals in place, these trade rules in place, so that they get more and more money. So we have, you know, I mean, we're running a $500-600 billion a year trade deficit, which means that those people in other countries have $500-600 billion that they can bring back to the United States and buy more of us. We're doing this because under Citizens United, they can buy our members of Congress. That's what this is all about.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So it gets back to trade, but it also gets back to money and politics. It's amazing. 240 years old, and here we are. And welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour. And Leon watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Broomfield, New Jersey. Hey, Leon, what's on your mind?
How are you doing?
I'm well.
Well, that was a little disappointing where that was kind of gave a free pass. Now, where is the...
Either they gave her a free pass or she didn't, you know, James Comey is a Republican. I mean, he's a man of high integrity. He's the guy who stood up to Alberto Gonzalez, if you'll recall. You know, he went over and John Ashcroft was in his hospital bed, and Gonzalez wanted Ashcroft to, you know, sign some document that would have given away our privacy and stuff. And Comey thought it was illegal, unconstitutional, and he worked for Ashcroft, and he drove like a maniac to get over to that hospital bed. I'm not doubting this guy's integrity. So
what about the Clinton Foundation and that money laundering?
Well, that'll be next.
Situation. That's not over yet either, is it?
That'll be, you know, it's not. I guarantee you that is not going to lead to anything. Well, I can't guarantee that, but you know that there's no criminal stuff there. But there's, you know, this book Clinton Cash is out there. The Republicans and Fox News and the paid Republicans who call into this program are going to be pounding on that constantly. You know, we're going to get calls about that, you know, throughout the election season. And it doesn't help Hillary Clinton's image as being, you know, trustworthy at all. In fact, it contradicts it. It makes it seem that she's untrustworthy, which I guess is her principal image.
Now, the Bernie's, how come they didn't put the TPP, stopping the TPP in the platform? Or, the fracking.
They didn't, Leon, and we're wandering far afield here. Thanks for the call. Ray, apparently you've got a long list of complaints, and that's fine. But Ray in Long Island. Hey, Ray, thanks for watching Free Speech.
Hi, Tom. What's annoying me now is this kumbaya attitude that is going to be assumed by the liberal Clinton-Bernie total audience. Total devotees. This is the thing that usually destroys the Democratic candidates. They don't seem to be able to continue to focus themselves. They're so happy with a little victory. I just wanted to point out that when I've caught you before, I should have stressed the fact that I was in advertising from 1960 through 1980. I was a media planner buyer in 1968.
You've told me this story before, right?
Lois. I worked on Bobby Kennedy's campaign primaries,
right.
And at the same time, I worked on Jake Chavez. Sounds like a crazy story, but it's true. I only wanted to point out that a character has flitted through the airwaves a few weeks ago, a guy named Ken Starr. Ken Starr was a special investigator for the Clintons' involvement of fiscal adventures and theft in Arkansas. That was what his official appointment to investigate. He came up with nothing. He came up with the fact that they lost $54,000.
Yeah, I'm Whitewater. Yeah, you're right. Ray, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
On April 15, 1949, Pacifica Radio KPFA 94.1 FM, Berkeley, California, went on the air for the first time, introducing listener-sponsored community radio to America.
Racism is not simply about the color. It's about structures of oppression and repression. And today, it is impossible really to understand the nature of racism unless we also recognize the role that the so-called war against terror has played.
American political activist, scholar, and author Angela Davis. Did you know that you can get most any of the 50,000 Pacifica broadcasts in our collection? Visit us online at PacificaRadioArchives.org and help support the Archives' mission to preserve Pacifica's broadcast legacy.
Welcome to the Million Color Revolution.
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. So my point on this whole trade thing is we had an interesting 4th of July. My brother John and his wife and their son are visiting, or were visiting. They flew out today for the 4th. And Sunday, we took the Spirit of Mount Vernon cruise, which is just a boat that goes a mile and a half down, or an hour and a half down the Potomac to Mount Vernon, and visited the concentration camp that George Washington used to run at Mount Vernon. And which was fascinating. I've been to Monticello, I've been to Jefferson's place, and I was surprised by how small it was, frankly, how basically kind of modest his house was. Not so much so with George Washington. It was a much bigger and fancier place. And as many as 300 slaves at one point in time. I mean, this was a major concentration camp. And it was interesting to me how, what it got me thinking about was how you create wealth. Because Washington was actually doing that to a large extent. I mean, George Washington was quite the entrepreneur compared with Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson basically just grew things. But Washington was, they were making iron products there. He had a blacksmith shop. I mean, they did it at Jefferson's place too, but not to the extent that Washington was. And he owned a major distillery. He was making whiskey. And all this kind of stuff. And it struck me, what is wealth? And how do we create it? And this is a conversation that, this is kind of basic economics that most Americans, never studied in school, tragically, and don't understand. And I was really getting as I was walking around that plantation, I was like, okay, what, how did he get all this stuff? How did he build all these buildings? How did he have this lifestyle? Well, first of all, he had it through the exploitation of slave labor. In fact, from everything I know or everything I've read, the economy of the South simply wouldn't have worked, or it would have worked far more modestly had there not been slave labor. So that was the principal source of it. But the other thing is, or that represented the wealth of Washington and many of his contemporaries. But the other thing was, wealth is a nation's wealth. Adam Smith, in 1776, he wrote this book, The Wealth of Nations. And the wealth of a nation is the consequence not of its economic activity necessarily. We can have a simple economy, and I've used this example a million times to describe, a so-called free market, where I mow your lawn every week and you wash my car every week, right? Every weekend. And that is, in theory, a pure free market because you and I are just contracting with each other to do that. But what happens if, while washing your car, I break your window and then refuse to pay for it? Well, then you have to go to court, right? Which now we're talking about, it's not free trade anymore. Now it's regulated trade because there are rules. Right? So, but I'm digressing slightly here. The point is that if I wash your car and you mow my lawn or vice versa every weekend, we're not creating anything of wealth. We're moving money around. We've got what looks like a GDP happening here, but we're not creating wealth. So how do you create wealth? You convert raw materials into finished goods that represent greater value. So that pile of dirt, which is filled with iron ore, becomes an anvil or a bunch of horseshoes eventually. And so that represents now wealth, the anvil, the horseshoes, you know, making the steel, making the iron and making the steel and then, you know, shaping it. So it's the application of human labor to raw materials that creates wealth. And which is a fancy way of saying manufacturing creates wealth. And that was, I just couldn't stop thinking about that all the time I was walking around Mount Vernon with my family. That the human labor that was being applied, first of all, was enslaved labor. And, you know, thus all this wealth was being created not by George Washington, but by his slaves, A. And B, setting aside, well, you can't really set aside slavery, but you know, in addition to that argument, the George Washington got it. That manufacturing is what creates wealth. He understood that. And that's why he had Alexander Hamilton come up with his 11-point plan for American manufacturing. So even that part of the country, the northern part of the country that was not operating on slave labor, could become an industrial powerhouse, which we did. I'll amplify that a little bit on the other side. It's also the summer. Anything you want to talk about, give us a call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
So my thoughts on globalization, the wealth of nations, what we need to do to move forward on this stuff, and your calls on pretty much any topic you want right after this.
It's Tuesday, June 28, 2016.
Historic floods devastating coal mining country.
More deadly floods, this time in West Virginia.
Dozens of homes exploded. Roads covered in smoke and flames.
Raging wildfire kills two in California, destroys hundreds of homes. Brexit could undermine international emissions agreement. Volkswagen to pay $15 billion in emissions cheating scandal. Plus, TransCanada demands $15 billion from the U.S. for rejecting its Keystone XL pipeline.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Joining us live from the devastation this morning with the very latest is West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who's seen these types of floods a number of times in that state.
Well, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Oh, man. Fox News, even when they cover climate change, they can't tell the truth about it. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I hate it when stuff that you have warned us about for years actually comes to pass. But I'm afraid we're looking at that in both West Virginia and California today.
Yes, unfortunately. More historic deadly floods, just like last year in South Carolina, just like 2 weeks ago in Houston, this week hitting West Virginia. President Obama has approved federal disaster aid, and West Virginia Governor Earl Ray Tomlin has declared a state of emergency after record rainfall triggered flash floods that have killed at least 23 people, destroyed thousands of homes and businesses across the state over the weekend. West Virginia's former governor and current Democratic Senator Joe Manchin said he has never seen anything like it.
This is unbelievable. I mean, I've never seen water this high. The waters just rose so quickly. There was such a deluge of water coming at us. It never eased up at all, and people just couldn't get out. Wow. And it hit for almost 2 days.
One river rose 9 feet in 1 hour. The PGA Tour canceled its event at Greenbrier Resort because the golf course was flooded. Now, the owner of that Greenbrier Resort is billionaire Jim Justice, a coal baron and climate science denier who also happens to be the Democratic Party's nominee for governor.
And that gives you an indication of how bad things are in West Virginia coal country when the leading Democratic candidate for governor is also a climate change denier. Just unbelievable. What will it take?
The National Weather Service has declared this a 1,000-year rainfall event, but these events are now happening so frequently that they may need to revise those metrics. It's the opposite problem in California, where Governor Jerry Brown has declared a state of emergency over fast-moving, deadly wildfire in Kern County, north of Los Angeles. That has killed at least 2 people and destroyed more than 200 homes, burning over 60 square miles. Driven by high winds and historic drought, officials now say firefighters are gaining some control over the blaze, despite working in temperatures over 100 degrees.
And it's not the only fire. There are some 9 different wildfires across Southern California as we go to air here today.
In international news, in the wake of the monumental vote for Britain to exit the European Union, called Brexit for short, scientists and environmental groups are warning that it could have far-reaching implications for international climate change policy and agreements related to climate science research. Political leaders of the Leave campaign are climate science skeptics who could weaken Britain's progress in phasing out coal and its commitments to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the landmark Paris Agreement. If the exit proceeds, UN officials say the Paris Agreement emissions targets may have to be recalibrated. In the U.S., pipeline company TransCanada on Friday officially filed a formal request seeking to recover costs and damages after President Obama rejected a permit for their controversial proposed Keystone XL pipeline across the U.S. They're using a mechanism in NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which allows foreign corporations to sue national governments over unfavorable regulations. Environmental groups say TransCanada's move illustrates how a similar mechanism in the pending TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, now awaiting approval by the U.S. Congress, can also be used to weaken environmental policy.
So we used our own sovereign decision-making process on whether their pipeline can come down here into the U.S., and now they're saying we have to pay them $15 billion for having made that decision?
That's right.
Hell of a thing, these trade deals. How do I get a piece of that?
Finally, Volkswagen has reached a settlement with federal regulators in its emissions cheating scandal. The German carmaker will pay over $15 billion in fines and penalties. It's the largest in automotive history after it admitted last fall that it intentionally installed illegal software on its cars to cheat on U.S. vehicle emissions tests. If approved by a federal court, the settlement includes an estimated $10 billion to buy back cars from owners in the U.S., $5 billion for environmental damages, and investments in zero-emissions vehicles. Earlier this month, Volkswagen announced a sweeping overhaul of its product line. It promises to deliver 30 new plug-in electric vehicle models within the next 10 years.
And they continue to face criminal investigation as well in that scandal, do they not?
Yes, they do.
For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Let me present to you my Volkswagen Blues, ready to carry me away, a long way to reach the...
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. There's a lot going on around the world. We've had all these suicide attacks over the last few days of Ramadan here. 3 bombs going off in Saudi Arabia. It's interesting that the country which has cultivated, encouraged, paid for, and helped spread Wahhabism, Salafism, this hard right form of Islam that prescribes things like, you know, cutting people's heads off, which they do in Saudi Arabia every Friday in the town square in Jeddah, I believe it is. And the whole idea that, you know, dying in jihad is you know, somehow you get to heaven. I mean, the basic philosophies that are animating the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda come right straight out of this bizarre cult within Islam, which the Saudi government has officially subsidized for over 100 years. And now those very same people just blew up three suicide bombs and bombers in Saudi Arabia. I am hoping that this will cause the Saudis to say, you know, we are Dr. Frankenstein and we created a monster, and it's time for us to dial back on that. But I think that they're afraid now that if they do, if they start going against the Wahhabis, that they themselves are going to become the targets, and it's apparently already starting. And this is going to get very, very messy. But it's a classic case of the chickens coming home to roost. But I was talking trade. Just to finish that rant, I want to go back and finish that rant. Paul Krugman in yesterday's New York Times, since we're talking about trade here. Donald Trump seems to be talking a good game on trade, right? He's saying, oh, we lost all our jobs, and, you know, I'm going to bring those jobs back. Okay, you're going to bring those jobs back. Are you going to let people have a union when they bring them back? Trump would say, no. Trump has spent millions trying to prevent his own employees from unionizing. You think he wants to bring back manufacturing jobs with unions? You know, I've told the story many times about my dad working in a tool and die shop for 40 years. It was a union job. It was a union shop. He had a union job. And so he was able to raise me and my three brothers and my mom. And, you know, he didn't raise my mom, but you know what I mean? Provide a good life for us. It was a good middle class life. But it wasn't just because it was manufacturing. See, manufacturing is not some magical panacea in terms of workers. There's a real difference here that people need to wrap their heads around. And that is, you know, what's best for the country in terms of trade policy and the importance of having manufacturing. Manufacturing, when Ronald Reagan came into office, manufacturing was 25% of the American economy. Well, actually, back in the 1960s, by the time Reagan came along, it was in the high teens, maybe to around 20%. Now it's 10% of our economy, manufacturing. So, and as I was pointing out earlier, manufacturing is what creates wealth. So you want to create wealth, you want to expand manufacturing. But that's only half the equation. Now, that's the part Trump is talking about. Trump is saying, oh, you know, we need to, you know, stop the crazy trade deals and bring the jobs back. Well, Bernie's saying the same thing. And to some extent now, Hillary Clinton is starting to sing this song. But the other half that the Republicans will never say, but that the Democrats will always tell you, is it's not enough to just bring back manufacturing jobs. GM is hiring people at $14 an hour. I mean, it's not enough to just bring back manufacturing jobs. We have to bring back the unions. And we need to change compensation rules for senior executives so that they can't take hundreds of millions of dollars in stock options as compensation. So that they're not just responsive to their stockholders, but they're also responsive to their employees, to their community, to their customers, to the institution of the company, and to their stockholders. So, you know, Trump could bring back manufacturing all day long. Yeah, I mean, this is the same problem we have with the service economy. McDonald's jobs or Walmart jobs or, you know, retail jobs are not inherently terrible jobs. I mean, there are people who are waiters in fancy restaurants who make, you know, over $100 an hour, because, you know, on tips, because they happen to be at one of these insanely expensive, super fancy restaurants. It's not inherently a terrible job. It's just that because we don't have unions, because we have lousy labor protections, most service jobs pay squat. And if you bring back manufacturing without changing the laws around labor, you're just going to bring back manufacturing jobs that pay squat. So it's more than just changing your trade policies. You've got to change your trade policies, and then we've got to undo. I mean, you know, Ronald Reagan was the first president in the history of the United States to install in his cabinet a Secretary of Labor who was actively hostile to labor, who hated unions. And that's something that needs to be fixed. That's something that very much needs to be fixed. Anyhow, as I said, it's anything goes summer. We'll pick up your calls here. Alan in Chiefland, Florida. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Good afternoon. I heard on the news that the Congress has suggested to the supervisors of the Park Service that they find corporate sponsors for the national parks.
Yeah, the Republicans.
Personally,
in Congress,
I would not
yes.
like to visit the Exxon Everglades or the Google Geyser, but I will hang up and I'd like to listen to your opinion on that particular aspect of what we're doing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. What you're looking at here is the beginning of, well, not the beginning, but it's another piece of this you know, multi-decade long Republican campaign to basically privatize everything. I'm going to be talking about this some more in the second hour. I'm going to get into it in some considerable detail. But and the first step towards privatization is putting corporate names and logos on things. And what it does is it blurs in the minds of people the difference between what's public and what's private. And that's wrong, right? What's public should be public, and what's private should be private. You know, and as I said, I'm gonna get into this in more detail in the next hour, but you know, this is just the Republicans saying, you know, oh well, we can't afford our public parks because we don't want to raise taxes on rich people to pay for them. And so, but it's really not even that. It's really, hey, these parks represent value. There's raw material underneath there. You know, we could dig up the iron ore. We could dig up the mine. You know, we could mine the gold. We could drill out the oil and gas. We could frack the lands. Or they have an intrinsic value that can be exploited. We can turn the parks into Disneyland kind of attractions. Somebody can make a buck off these things. So why are we doing them, you know, for the public good? It's because we understand the difference between public and private. Jared in Downington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jared, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. With the recent 4th of July, we have to take I want everybody to think about that as recently as June 30th,
Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense?
Yes. He repealed the regulations in the U.S. military banning open service from transsexual Americans.
Right. And, transgender is the term of art these days, but yeah.
Yes. And I'd like to take into account that first of all, that Obama has done a pretty good job when it comes to the military. Like, I mean, he's gotten rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, including now trans people. He now allows women to fight in military combat roles. I mean, this guy, you know, he makes Truman, like, on steroids, basically. And my second point is that if Donald Trump was in the White House, I don't think he would have done this if he was in the position today to appoint, you know, somebody like Ashton to
Ash Carter.
Secretary. Yeah, Ash Carter. Yeah. To the United States Defense Department.
Yeah. Well, Carter's carrying out, I have no idea what Carter's personal opinion is of these things, but he's carrying out the policy of his president, which is a good thing. And I agree with you. I think if Donald Trump was in the White House, first of all, he would be catering to the Republican base, which is basically, you know, the base of the base is the bigots. And, you know, they're bigoted whether it has to do with skin color or whether it has to do with sexual orientation or whatever. I mean, if they can figure out a reason to hate somebody, religion, national origin, ethnicity, if they can figure out a reason to hate somebody, accent, they will do it. Right. So Trump would have been catering to them. Secondly, Donald Trump views women as objects. I mean, he's a classic case. Jared, thanks for the call. Donald Trump, I mean, look at his statements. Not only is he so blind to his own white privilege, he's equally blind to his own male privilege. And he objectifies women constantly, including his own daughter, his own kids, his own wives. I mean, you're right.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Donald Trump may talk a nice line about being, you know, tolerant and all that sort of thing, but, you know, as a Republican, A and B. And welcome back, Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I have a slightly different point of view, I believe, when it comes to monetary wealth than I think you might have.
Sure.
For me, basically, they fall in two different divisions of monetary wealth. The first one is what I call the honest wealth, which is what I might have after 20 or 30 years of honest labor or work, where I've managed to save money outside what my budgetary monthly and yearly needs are that I can use maybe to pay for vacation or some other fun kind of stuff, things that I want to do, versus the dishonest wealth, which is what you find in with corporate executives like at Walmart, where they can afford to pay $800,000 a year legal attorney fees, salaries, and a Learjet or two to go around and bully and intimidate Walmart managers and Walmart workers who may want to advocate for himself. In other words, unionize.
Right. Johnny, your
non-monetary type is something maybe I want to pass on my house to one of my kids when I pass on. And it's that as opposed to something Mitt Romney might do. He might have a half a dozen homes, which I think is extraordinary wealth, which makes that uneven playing field that we referred to many times in the past. So I think there is a differentiation there. Like my dead uncle once said, too much no good, plenty's enough.
Right.
That's the Zen kind of philosophy I apply towards deciding what is appropriate and inappropriate wealth.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Johnny, and I think that that's a reasonable analysis. My point was, where does the original wealth come from? What creates the wealth of nations?
Well, and when you look at a country like the United States, we have a variety of topography and mineral resources and all. Compare that to a desert country, which has relatively little. You go to an African nation that's surrounded by sand. You know, the wealth that you derive from there is going to be way different than what you have in here in the United States. So from the basic point of view, yeah, the resources too. You multiply that by human labor over time. Assuming you have control over your time and your labor, that creates the kind of wealth that you want.
Yeah. Exactly, but the resources
working at slave wages at Walmart.
Yeah, the resources are not wealth until they're exploited, though. They're just natural resources. I mean, they it's sort of like kinetic energy. I mean, it represents potential wealth or potential energy. Excuse me, it represents potential wealth, but it's not wealth in actual practice. And so, it's the mining of that, and that's one of the reasons why many of these countries that don't have a lot of natural resources, in quotes, although it's estimated that just Afghanistan has $1 trillion worth of rare earth elements. But nonetheless, those countries that don't have a lot of natural resources, a lot of them have a lot of sunlight. And that's where solar technology could convert them into net producers of energy, which I would argue is a form of wealth. You're manufacturing energy out of sunlight. And sunlight being the raw material. And so here you have another way that a nation can develop wealth is by, exploiting the natural resource of the sun, which, very, very less destructive process than, using oil, for example, to power things.
Hey, Tom?
Yeah.
You're not only a scholar and gentleman, but you're also a physicist.
Oh, yeah.
Great explanation.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, I always enjoyed physics. Johnny, thank you lots for thanks for the call. Thanks for your kind words. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the end. It is 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff in Grants Pass, Oregon. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I just want to say thanks for your voice of sanity.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hey, you know, looking at this whole political season and looking at the two candidates that we're presented with, somehow we got the two least popular candidates we could possibly get. I was just pointing out that both conventions could do America a favor by nominating other people.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen, Jeff. And so, you know, the extent to which there's not a massive amount of enthusiasm around Hillary Clinton and there's actually a, you know, anti-enthusiasm around Trump in the Republican Party, my concern is that what this is going to do is it's going to influence down-ticket races. So, you know, we still need to not just still, I mean, you know, we need to find some enthusiasm for the top of the ticket. And I think, you know, Hillary Clinton may well be a very, very good president. We've got some very trying times coming up in this country. And having a Democrat in the White House, in my opinion, is going to be a critically important thing for the future of this country. And having a Republican in the White House, I don't know if you've noticed, there's a new biography out about George W. Bush. It's called Bush, by a presidential historian who's written a number of great biographies of other presidents. And he basically comes right out and says, you know, I'm not saying that George W. Bush is the worst president in history, but history may well record that. And he opens the book by talking about the invasion of Iraq as the worst foreign policy blunder in the history of the United States, in the 240-year history of this country. And so we need Democrats, please. And there's a lot of great people running for Congress as well. So it's like this is not a time to disengage. You can't say, well, you know, I liked Bernie better than Hillary, or I'm not all that enthusiastic. Hey, you know, get over it. At least so far, on the Republican side, the nominee is or will be Donald Trump. On the Democratic side, the nominee is or will be Hillary Clinton, and we're going to have to work with that. And we're going to have to work with that in a way that, in particular, in state races, in the House races, and in Senate races, gets as many Democrats elected as possible, because the challenges that we face are not going to be handled well by a Republican Party that is completely in bed with transnational corporations. It ain't going to happen. Colette in Los Angeles. Hey, Colette, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just kind of wanted to dovetail in on the fact that capitalism and the development financially of this country is solely due to slavery. This country was built on the wealth of slavery. And I think that's an issue, regardless of the tactical or the analytical part of what our forefathers came up with. Without that labor, this country would have never developed the way that it has. And in addition, we talk about today the working conditions. The problem is that the powers that be cannot move away from that model of slave labor. I'll take my response off there. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Colette. I think that the legacy of slavery is still with us, and I'm not talking about the obvious stuff like, you know, institutional racism and structural racism and all those sorts of things. The institution of slavery was in early America was a classic expression of feudalism, of European feudalism. Basically, the peasants were slaves. They were the property, literally the property of the landowners. You know, slavery has been practiced in other forms by other names throughout history. The Greeks had slaves, the Romans had slaves. And you're absolutely right. This country would not have developed the way it did, or at least it wouldn't have developed as rapidly as it did without slave labor. And I believe this to be true. I read this in one of the histories of America some years back, that the quote value, and see it's represented as labor, but the quote value of all the slaves in the South was greater than all the industrial and land property in the North. So, you know, it was a very big deal. But I would say that the part of the legacy of slavery that's still with us is this idea that businesses are basically kingdoms, that labor is disposable, that if a company wants to, you know, is in search of greater profits, they can simply pick up their factory and move someplace else. There's a fundamental question here. And this is the fundamental question that, you know, if you're going to have an argument with a libertarian, you want to ask. Is the economy here to serve society, we the people? Or are we the people here to serve the owners, masters, overlords of the economy? Which is it? Now, libertarians would say the latter, that we the people are here to serve those who own the economy, the makers. We are the takers. Right? That would be their sales pitch. And that's essentially the Republican pitch. A Democrat or a progressive would say, no, the economy is here to serve we the people. Which raises the question, how do you construct an economy that serves the people? And, you know, we've done this before, or at least an economy that served white men. You know, we did this from the 30s to the 80s. And we could do it again in a far more inclusive way. And you do that by shifting power away from basically the feudal lords, the slave owners, whatever comparison you want to make, to the people, so that they're no longer slaves and serfs. They have some say in things. You could do this with economic co-ops. You do this with unions. You do this with labor-friendly policies like, you know, paid time off. In other words, setting the rules of the game by having government regulate the game of business. You can't exploit people beyond, in these ways. This is, you know, no child labor. Here's a minimum wage. Here are workplace health and safety rules. Here are environmental pollution rules. And it's very straightforward stuff. But this is the core issue here.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.